This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 1 year from today, we'll be voting for president. Today, we're going to listen back to presidents from throughout the century and compare their oratory styles. A new box set of CDs collects historic presidential speeches from 1908 to 1993. It's a co-production of the Library of Congress and Rhino Records. My guests Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham compiled the collection. They're both with the Library of Congress's Division of Motion Pictures, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound. The first recording we're going to hear will give us some clue to what presidential campaigns were like at the turn of the century. This is an excerpt of a 1908 studio recording of a stump speech by William Howard Taft when he was running against William Jennings Bryan. 1908 was the first year sound recordings were a prominent part of a presidential campaign.
The combination of capital in large plants and manufactured goods with the greatest economy is just as necessary as the assembling of the parts of a machine to the economical and more rapid manufacture of what in old times was made by hand. The government should not interfere with one any more than the other, when such aggregations of capital are legitimate and are properly controlled, for they are then the natural results of modern enterprise and are beneficial to the public. In the proper operation...
Sam Brolowski, Cooper Graham, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you.
So in 1908, the president went into a recording studio and just made a recording. We're not hearing him addressing a crowd.
Absolutely not. You're hearing... one of many 78 RPM disc sides that the president and his opponent, William Jennings Bryan, recorded in 1908, of course. And they're believed to be, you know, excerpts of their standard stump speeches of that time.
Now, what about the content of the speech?
Well, I think the content is very interesting. You don't really hear people talking about the aggregate of capital, legitimate capital, the way Taft does in the speech. And you hear it's a meaty speech of very specific issues. They talked about issues which were very prominent at the time, some of which were very complex, ones in which we don't even know anything about now.
Well, let's move ahead to President Theodore Roosevelt, and let's hear a speech from 1912 that you've recorded in this new anthology. And Sam, what is interesting about the speech we're about to hear?
Well, one thing I guess I need to say as an aside is that we say we've recorded every president of the 20th century. Roosevelt, of course, was not president in 1912. He was president from 1901 to 1909, and he didn't record in 1904, for instance, when he ran for office. But in 1912, he was the Bull Moose candidate, the Progressive Party candidate. He was the third party candidate, the most popular, successful third party candidate in our history, I believe. So you're hearing a presidential candidate who was whose presidency was succeeded by William Howard Taft, who ran initially on the mantle of carrying forth Roosevelt's policies, but I think disappointed the progressive wing of the Republican Party. So Theodore Roosevelt comes and runs again in 1912 against the Democrat Woodrow Wilson and the Republican William Howard Taft.
Let's hear this Teddy Roosevelt speech from 1912. But before we hear it, Cooper, let me ask you to explain what we're about to hear, to put it in some kind of context for us so we understand what he's talking about.
Okay, when you hear the speech, you hear a rather pedantic voice, and you may not realize that this is really a wonderful performance by Teddy Roosevelt. To give a little background, there had been some campaign and some Senate investigations of campaign irregularities that had been held in 1912, and Mr. Archibald, I forget his first name, was asked to testify on behalf of Standard Oil. He was head of Standard Oil at the time, and he complained bitterly that a dog in Abyssinia would not have been treated as badly as Standard Oil had been treated by Mr. Roosevelt during his administration. And so Mr. Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, takes this statement and repeats it and then says with great relish how much he enjoyed giving the Abyssinian treatment to Standard Oil, which of course was the biggest and worst of the trust during this antitrust period, and how he is going to continue to administer the same Abyssinian treatment to the other malefactors among the trusts. So while it sounds like a very dry speech, really it's the speech of a great fighter And I think it's a wonderful performance by President Roosevelt.
Let's hear an excerpt of this speech.
What was really interesting in their testimony, however, was the sidelight it cast on their own motives and standards of propriety, and incidentally, an unwitting tribute to the attitude of my administration. If you will turn to page 133 of the record, you can get the record, I will say incidentally, from your senator, unless he's a stand-pat senator, in which case you probably can't get it from him. If you will turn to page 133 of the record, you will find where Mr. Archibald says, substantially, Dorcas Abyssinia can show nothing to compare with the treatment administered to the Standard Oil Corporation during the administration of President Roosevelt. In this instance, Mr. Archibald is testifying to what is quite correct. I did administer the Abyssinian treatment to the Standard Oil Corporation while I was president. I administered it because I thought the Standard Oil needed it. And if ever I am president again, and the Standard Oil or any other corporation acts as the Standard Oil then did, I'll administer the Abyssinian treatment to it again.
Teddy Roosevelt recorded in 1912, and what we just heard is included on a new CD box set called The Library of Congress Presents Historic Presidential Speeches, 1908 to 1993. My two guests co-produced this box set. Cooper Graham and Sam Berlosky both work with the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Now, how was the recording we just heard used in its time?
Well, these recordings by Roosevelt and the opposition were made by a number of companies, notably Victor Talking Machine Company and Columbia Records, and we know a little about them. We know that they were sold. I'm sure that the Democratic and Republican organizations and the Bull Moose organization bought copies to give to people. But also, interestingly enough, there were they created something then. I guess you would call them phonograph record debates, which Cooper turned up interesting records of these in newspapers when we were researching this set.
In Seattle in 1908, supporters of Bryan and supporters of Taft would play the record sort of at each other. And while one candidate record was playing occasionally, the other side would enter with a rather raucous song in answer. And so it's very interesting because once, for instance, you could hear Taft on a colonial policy of the United States, and then you'd play the Bryan record loudly denouncing the same issue. So I'm sure there was a certain amount of ballyhoo to it, but on the other hand, I think it shows that the interest that the general public had in listening to the voices, the actual voices of the candidates.
So people would gather in, say, an auditorium and hear recordings of the sound recordings of the different candidates?
Sure. Actually, another newspaper clip mentioned that William Allen White, when Theodore Roosevelt was recording some of the speech that you hear, he said that these will be played in church halls to groups of interested electors so they can make up their mind about the candidates. A lot of these seem to be for public consumption in groups.
My guests are Sam Berlosky and Cooper Graham of the Library of Congress. We'll talk more and hear more presidential speeches after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Sam Berlosky and Cooper Graham. They've co-produced a CD box set called The Library of Congress Presents Historic Presidential Speeches, 1908 to 1993. Now let's jump ahead to FDR and one of his fireside chats. Before we hear an excerpt of the fireside chat, what was the significance of President Roosevelt's addresses on the radio?
Well, I think one significance is that Roosevelt took office during an incredible crisis, not just the Great Depression, which was, become so important in 19, 1933 when he took office, in March of 1933. But at that time also, as soon as he took office, he took action on the banks of the United States. And this speech is made within 2 weeks of him taking office, as I recall.
So this would be his very first fireside chat.
It was probably his very first public address after his inaugural address. So it's significant that here he went directly to the people. He didn't give a speech to Congress. He didn't go to a major organization. He went directly to the people. And this was a very significant thing that Roosevelt did by going to the people so often through radio. It sort of usurped machine politics at the time. One traces the descendancy of machine politics to Franklin Roosevelt and the fact that he skips over them and goes directly to the people over the radio through what were called intimate chats.
So before we hear this 1933 fireside chat, Roosevelt's first fireside chat, tell us what the crisis is that he's addressing so we can hear this in context.
There was a depression, and the depression had gotten worse and worse to the point where a lot of banks were having all their money pulled by anxious depositors who felt that all the banks were going to fail. Of course, any bank has far more deposits in it than it has cash on hand, so the banks would have, there would have been a run on all the banks in the United States, and there would have been complete financial panic. Roosevelt has the reputation of being a liberal, but at that point, I think the business community was sufficiently frightened that they were also asking that he take any steps that were necessary to try to avert this crisis. I don't think most people now can imagine how serious it was. So there was an awful lot riding on this speech to try to persuade Americans not to pull their money out of the banks.
So let's hear it. This is Franklin Roosevelt, his first fireside chat, 1933.
First of all, let me state the simple fact that when you deposit money in a bank, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault. It invests your money in many different forms of credit, in bonds and commercial paper and mortgages and in many other kinds of loans. In other words, the bank puts your money to work to keep the wheels of industry and of agriculture turning round. A comparatively small part of the money that you put into the bank is kept in currency, an amount which in normal times is wholly sufficient to cover the cash needs of the average citizen. In other words, the total amount of all the currency in the country is only a comparatively small proportion of the total deposits in all the banks of the country. What then happened during the last few days of February and the first few days of March? Because of undermined confidence on the part of the public, there was a general rush by a large portion of our population to turn bank deposits into currency or gold. A rush so great that the soundest banks couldn't get enough currency to meet the demand. The reason for this was that on the spur of the moment, it was of course impossible to sell perfectly sound assets of a bank and convert them into cash except at panic prices far below their real value.
Franklin Roosevelt recorded in 1933 his first fireside chat. What was the public reaction to that first chat?
It was very, very favorable. Not, of course, the expected panic didn't take place, which is negative evidence, but seemed to be proof that a lot of people listened to the speech and took the president's words to heart. Also, there was an incredible amount of mail. The White House received something like four or five times the mail it had received after a speech by the previous administrations, to the point where they had to hire extra people to deal with it. So the response to Roosevelt's speech was overwhelming. One commentator says that within the space of this speech, capitalism was saved. Maybe it was.
You have an earlier radio address to the nation by President Herbert Hoover, recorded in 1931, just a couple of years before the fireside chat that we heard. Why don't we hear an excerpt of Hoover's address? How would you compare Hoover's use of radio to Roosevelt's?
It's certainly professional, but he hasn't mastered the medium as Roosevelt would.
What's this address about?
Unemployment relief. Same big subject, the Great Depression.
Let's hear it.
Over 1,000 towns and cities have been well organized and experienced unemployment relief committees, community chests, or other agencies for efficient administration of this relief. With this occasion begins the nationwide movement to aid each of these volunteer organizations in securing the funds to meet their task over the forthcoming winter. This organized effort is our opportunity to express our sympathy, to lighten the burdens of the heavy laden, and to cast sunshine into the habitation of despair. The amount sought by
Herbert Hoover, recorded in 1931. What was the public response to this radio address?
I think it was favorable. The problem was, I think most people felt it didn't go far enough and that more government action was needed. And this is what Mr. Hoover did not want to do. He felt he wanted to keep the federal government out of it and try to get the local communities to take responsibility for what was happening, especially in large urban centers. I think this would have been difficult to do. But as far as the response went, I think most people wanted to do what they could about the Depression. I just think that they didn't feel this went quite far enough.
So what network actually broadcast the address we just heard?
Well, I'm sure NBC did, but it's likely that all the networks did. CBS, all the networks were really NBC and CBS. NBC had two networks at the time, the Red and Blue Network, and then CBS.
They did have a major hookup for this, and several opera singers sang before this, and there were some musical interludes, and it was a very, very large occasion. So it wasn't just the speech, but there was a lot going on around it. It's supposed to be an effort to do something about the Depression.
My guests are Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham. They're both with the Library of Congress, and they've co-produced a new box set of CDs that feature presidential addresses dating back to the very early 1900s. It's called The Library of Congress Presents Historic Presidential Speeches, 1908 to 1993. On this new CD box set, you've included a speech by President Truman, recorded in 1948 upon accepting the Democratic nomination for president. Why did you choose this speech from Truman?
Going into this campaign, Truman was very much the underdog. Most people didn't think he had much of a chance. And his speaking style was generally considered to be terrible. It was a very flat, pronounced Missouri accent. And people had been talking to him for years about changing his style, trying to make his sentence shorter and punchier. And if he really could speak to an audience the way he could speak to friends of his at a poker game, he would be a wonderful speaker. And for some reason, at 2 o'clock in the morning of his acceptance speech of the Democratic candidate in 48, he seemed to take their advice to heart, because you hear Truman at his best in his speech.
Let's hear an excerpt of this speech, Harry Truman from 1948, at the Democratic National Convention. He's accepting the nomination for president.
Confidence and security have been brought to the American people by the Democratic Party. Farm income has increased from less than $2.5 billion in 1933 to more than $18 billion in 1947. Never in the world were the farmers of any republic or any kingdom or any other country as prosperous as the farmers of the United States. And if they don't do their duty by the Democratic Party, they're the most ungrateful people in the world. Wages and salaries in this country have increased from $29 billion in 1933 to more than $128 billion in 1947. That's labor. And labor never had but one friend in politics, and that was the Democratic Party and Franklin D. Roosevelt. And I'll say to labor just what I've said to the farmers. They are the most ungrateful people in the world if they pass the Democratic Party by this year.
Harry Truman accepting the Democratic presidential nomination in 1948. I don't know if you'll agree with me on this, but it seems to me a presidential candidate would never call voters ungrateful. I mean, you don't say anything that could alienate any voters. What do you think?
I certainly agree with you. On the other hand, as Cooper said, this was 2 a.m. in the morning, so I'm not sure how many voters heard this address.
But there was also a drifting away, both by labor and by some of the farmers in 48, and I think it would not be considered to be necessarily a judicious thing to do, but it may have reminded them exactly who their friends were, and I think I would have been somewhat impressed by it if I'd been a union man or a farmer in 48.
Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham are with the Library of Congress. They've co-produced a CD box set called The Library of Congress Presents Historic Presidential Speeches, 1908 to 1993. It's co-produced by the Library of Congress and Rhino Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We'll be hearing many speeches by presidential candidates over the next year. On this election day, we're listening to presidential oratory from throughout the century. My guests, Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham, have produced a new CD box set of presidential speeches from 1908 to 1993. Brolowski and Graham are both with the Library of Congress's Division of Motion Pictures, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound. This is part two of our conversation. Let's jump ahead to 1969. You've included an address by President Nixon to the nation on the war in Vietnam. Why did you include this speech?
Well, this is the silent majority speech. In making the selections for this set, which were mostly done by Cooper here, we decided, or Cooper had a great idea, that for current recent presidents and the current presidents, and we started this thing during the Bush administration, that we would contact the presidents or their staffs or families to see what speech they would like to be represented by. Initially, this was a contact to say, gee, we're going to preserve a speech in a special new process with some experiments we're doing at the Library of Congress. What speech would you like to be assured was preserved for posterity? And all of the presidents or their families from Mrs. Onassis on responded, but the Nixon office did not respond to Cooper.
Therefore, we decided to go with a speech that President Nixon admired, and he had mentioned very favorably in the arena. That's the book, one of the books. He had mentioned his silent majority speech several times as being one of his best, and also he felt one that changed public opinion in the United States, so we decided to go along with it. And of course, the silent majority is one of the best-known sort of catchwords of the period. Also, since it deals with Vietnam, we thought it was a topical, not a topical speech, but a speech that dealt with that that epoch in American history. So for these reasons, we decided to go with a silent majority speech. Also, it was evidently partly the speech that some commentators have said marked out a new group in the United States, some Democrat, some Republican, that might vote for Republicans in the future. And this, in fact, seems to have been a pretty accurate prediction.
Okay, Richard Nixon, recorded in 1969.
I have chosen a plan for peace. I believe it will succeed. If it does not succeed, what the critics say now won't matter. Or if it does succeed, what the critics say now won't matter. If it does not succeed, anything I say then won't matter. I know it may not be fashionable to speak of patriotism or national destiny these days, but I feel it is appropriate to do so on this occasion. 200 years ago, this nation was weak and poor. But even then, America was the hope of millions in the world. Today, we have become the strongest and richest nation in the world. And the wheel of destiny has turned so that any hope the world has for the survival of peace and freedom will be determined by whether the American people have the moral stamina and the courage to meet the challenge of free world leadership. let historians not record that when America was the most powerful nation in the world, we passed on the other side of the road and allowed the last hopes for peace and freedom of millions of people to be suffocated by the forces of totalitarianism. And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support. I pledged in my campaign for the presidency to end the war in a way that we could win the peace. I have initiated a plan of action which will enable me to keep that pledge. The more support I can have from the American people, the sooner that pledge can be redeemed. For the more divided we are at home, the less likely the enemy is to negotiate at Paris. Let us be united for peace. Let us also be united against defeat. Because let us understand, North Vietnam cannot defeat or humiliate the United States. Only Americans can do that.
President Nixon's silent majority address, recorded in 1969 on the war in Vietnam. You know, it's interesting. I mean, he didn't reprise the words silent majority a lot during that address. What do you think it was about those words that caught on?
I think that sort of that, I don't know, I guess the polarizing aspect of the speech is what made it catch on by dividing the public into camps. It's important to remember that the context of this speech is all these mass demonstrations going on outside the White House at the time. So by calling someone silent, you're placing them, in comparison to these dirty hippies who were, you know, burning flags and having these sort of, in many cases, you know, unseemly protests going on in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial.
Now let's jump ahead to President Clinton. You've chosen a speech from 1993, his remarks to the convocation of the Church of God in Christ. What is this speech about, and what do you think it shows about Clinton's style of speech making?
Well, this speech is about race in the United States and class and economic policy in the United States. I think it was a very successful speech for him, at least in its immediate response. It was to an African-American audience in Memphis. I think that, as Cooper said earlier about President Truman, Clinton has a very good reputation for one-on-one speaking. He's a very charismatic speaker privately, and I don't think that his reputation is as good as a public speaker, but I think he tries to be somewhat intimate, if that's a word you can be, with the hundreds or thousands listening to this speech.
Okay, this is President Clinton, an excerpt of a speech to the convocation of the Church of God in Christ, 1993.
If Martin Luther King, who said, like Moses, I am on the mountaintop and I can see the promised land, but I'm not going to be able to get there with you. But we will get there. If he were to reappear by my side today and give us a report card on the last 25 years, what would he say? Say, you did a good job, he would say, voting and electing people who formerly were not electable because of the color of their skin. You have more political power, and that is good. You did a good job, he would say, letting people who have the ability to do so live wherever they want to live, go wherever they want to go in this great country. You did a good job, he would say, elevating people of color into the ranks of the United States Armed Forces to the very top, or into the very top of our government. You did a very good job, he would say. He would say, you did a good job creating a black middle class of people who really are doing well, and the middle class is growing more among African Americans than among non-African Americans. You did a good job. You did a good job in opening opportunity. But he would say, I did not live and die to see the American family destroyed. I I did not live and die to see 13-year-old boys get automatic weapons and gun down 9-year-olds just for the kick of it. I did not live and die to see young people destroy their own lives with drugs and then build fortunes destroying the lives of others. That is not what I came here to do. I fought for freedom, he would say, but not for the freedom of people to kill each other with reckless abandon, not for the freedom of children to have children and the fathers of the children walk away from them and abandon them as if they don't amount to anything. I fought for people to have the right to work, but not to have whole communities and people abandoned. This is not what I lived and died for. My fellow Americans, he would say, I fought to stop white people from being so filled with hate that they would wreak violence on black people. I did not fight for the right of black people to murder other black people with reckless abandon.
It's President Clinton, and that recording is included on the new box set of presidential recordings. The Library of Congress presents Historic Presidential Speeches, 1908 to 1993. My guests are the two co-producers of this box set, both from the Library of Congress, Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham. What do you find effective about the excerpt that we just heard?
I think the setting itself is significant. It's in the South. I couldn't prove this now, but I think his Southern accent is a little more pronounced than it is on a normal news conference, a televised news conference. And also, of course, he is in a church, and I think he, you know, President Clinton spent a lot of time going to church in the South, and I think there's a rhetorical style reflected, a sermon style reflected in this speech. I think he's very comfortable giving this speech. It's a accepting audience. This was not going to be a major address. I'm sure there were cameras there, but this was not for live television. This was for a group that he felt very comfortable with. I sort of erroneously called it intimate. It's not so much that it's a one-on-one style of speaking. It's obviously a very rhetorically flamboyant speech, but he's very comfortable, and I think he feels that the audience is very accepting of him while giving the speech.
You're both at the Library of Congress and work with sound recordings. Now, in the early 1900s, there weren't many sound recordings, so if you have something from a president, it's a wonderful, special, rare thing to have. What with local television and radio, national television and radio, and then C-SPAN, you know, playing this kind of stuff all the time, there's zillions and zillions now of presidential comments. What's it like for you? I mean, you're getting inundated with presidential speeches and other political speeches that you have to catalog.
Yes, we are. We are getting inundated. It's partially we welcome it. We would not want to have less. Of course, we would like to have more time and more people and more money to do it better, but I would certainly not want to see the flood stop. I think we're very privileged to live in an age where we can have this. Think what we would give. I keep mentioning Bryan's Cross of Gold speech, but think what it would be like to have that or the Gettysburg Address. So, and it's also very difficult to say what might not be important 20 years from now. So I think we have to take it all. And catalog it and store it and preserve it best we can.
Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham compiled the new CD box set, The Library of Congress Presents Historic Presidential Speeches, 1908 to 1993, on Rhino Records. This is Fresh Air.